Viens, petite fille, dans mon comic strip. Viens faire des bulles, viens faire des...
Whip,
des
clip, crack,
des,
bang,
des,
blanc,
et des...
Zip, shabam, pow, blanc, whew.
Je distribue les swings et les uppercuts. Ça fait,
Vlam,
ça fait,
splash,
et ça fait...
Stop,
ou bien,
bon,
ou parfois même...
Zip, shabam.
Viens, petite fille, dans mon comic strip. Viens faire des bulles, viens faire des...
Whip,
des...
Clip, crack,
des...
Bang,
des...
Blanc,
et des...
Zip, shabam, pow, blanc, whew.
Viens avec moi par-dessus les buildings. Ça fait...
Whip,
quand on s'envole et puis...
Cling,
après quoi je fais...
Tink,
et ça fait...
Boing, shabam.
Comic strip, viens faire des bulles, viens faire des...
Whip,
des...
Clip, crack,
des...
Bang,
des...
Blanc,
et des...
Zip, shabam, pow, blanc, whew.
N'aie pas peur, bébé, agrippe-toi.
Top,
je suis là,
crack,
pour te protéger.
Shack,
ferme les yeux,
crack,
embrasse-moi.
Slack, shabam, pow, blanc, whew.
You're listening to Ink Studs on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver from the UBC campus. This week's episode is going to be a little bit different than normal. I put together kind of an audio documentary collecting interviews looking at the subject as comics as a form of media and how that's worked within the greater concept of media. It's a project for one of my classes in school, and I hope you enjoy it. The guests for this project were Scott McLeod, Matt Madden, Tom Spurgeon, Jeet here, and Eddie Campbell. And thank you to all of them for joining in and allowing me to ask the same questions over and over again. And I think there's a lot of really interesting things that come out of it, a lot of debate and discussion points that kind of leave you thinking and give some new perspectives that you may have not heard before. Over the next week, I'll be posting the full copy of the interviews online, so you could listen to those by themselves or just listen to what I've kind of mashed together here, hopefully in some kind of cohesive narrative. I hope it works. It's my first time trying such a thing. Normally it's just a big long interview, and this is a different kind of beast. Check it out.
Where do the roots of comics stand in regards to other forms of media?
Comics, as I see them, really are rooted in sort of technologies of reproduction. That's to say, there's a school of thought, I guess Scott McLeod is one of them, who would see comics as simply being a question of sequential images. And if you use that definition, then you can go back to, you know, the drawings of the caveman and Egyptian hieroglyphics and the Beirut tapestry and whatnot. I don't think that actually works, because I think if you actually look at where comics are, they don't really go back to the Egyptian hieroglyphics. Like, there's no real connection. The actual roots of comics and the actual nature of comics always involve mass reproduction, technologies of reproduction. So what we're talking about is print, right?
Yeah.
The age of print, starting with Gutenberg. And then from there, what you can say is that the age of print, you know, allowed for the proliferation of images. David Kunzel talks about in his the various histories of comics that, you know, go back to the early modern times. But those aren't really comics. I mean, they are the roots of comics in the sense that these are books that have images, and the images have a narrative content. But I think the essential change that had to happen that to allow comics to come into being came about during the age of the Industrial Revolution in the 19th century. And what you had then that was very specific was a much easier method of reproduction with lithograph, and also the an increasing sense that time isn't like a river that just flows, that time can be broken down into units, right? Like, for the vast majority of human history, time was hard to break down because people just lived in time, but they didn't know how to measure time or how to... time was just like this sort of elemental force that humans couldn't control. But once you got the ability, increasingly with things like watches and clocks, to break down time, to have a division of time, to monitor how things change over time, then that allowed this new consciousness, which meant that artists were very aware of time. And I think the great pivotal figure is Tofur, the Swiss artist, who did sort of the earliest sort of proto-comics in the early 19th century. And if you look at his work, what's really interesting is that he's interested not just in sequential images, like the way that the Bayreuth tapestry might be, of here's one event or here's another, and also Hogarth, people in the 18th century all did this, you know, here's one event, here's another. He's interested in moments of time. Here is a man with a ball, here he's throwing the ball, here the ball is landing on someone else's hands, right? Mm-hmm. So he's actually interested in this breakdown of sequence of time. And I think that's very different. I think that's the great revolutionary moment that allowed comics as we come into being.
Jeet here is kind of a Canadian treasure in the critical aspect of looking at comics academically. He writes numerous articles for National Post, introductions to every good collection of comic strips you see coming out from the fine folks at Drawn and Quarterly and Fantagraphics, and I guess IDW now too with the Little Orphan Annie collections. He's got the books from University of, I think, Mississippi Press, Comic Studies Reader. Tom Spurgeon is the man behind the Comics Reporter website, ongoing comic news blog. I really value Tom's input on comics, and every review I've read by him, I've had to agree in everything he says. He's a fine critical mind.
I guess the way to put it is it's kind of one of those bastard art forms. It's not a pure art form. It's something that had a commercial construction, and had several commercial constructions over the years. Not just, there's nothing really linear about it. You can find roots or kind of sequential narratives all over the place, but nothing, as in the way that you kind of finally track down and can say that someone discovered America, you can kind of say that comics were kind of invented. You know, there's a commercial viability and a through line in the late 19th century on, but you know, all the antecedents, all the stuff that Scott and Jeet might be able to bring up, all the smart stuff, the tapestries and the German satirical newspaper cartoons and all that stuff, you know, can be seen as antecedents, but I think the commercial crystallization of the 19th century is probably what's important.
Eddie Campbell is the author of Alec and the Bacchus ongoing series, Fay the Artist from First Second Books, as well as the remarkable Tales of Monsieur Lyotard.
I'm finding more and more that I don't even think of comics as an entity, as a medium, in the way that people at McLeod do. I find myself totally at odds with the idea of comics. I realize this isn't a popular notion, and I don't care. I think what's going on, and on in what if we're talking about comic books. See, I think of comic books. Comic books is a genre of popular fiction in which the main characters routinely have superpowers, supernormal abilities. And the strip cartoons in the paper are a type of newspaper cartoon in the same way that the editorial cartoon, the political cartoon, or the gag cartoon. And I don't see the strip cartoon as being related to the comic book. The comic book is a, or the graphic novel as they're calling it nowadays, is simply the latest manifestation. Did I say that word right? The latest manifestation of a long line of popularly packaged fiction, going back to the dime novel up through the pulps and the paperbacks. And the fact that it's illustrated is simply a sign of our illiterate times, our post-cinema age, where we want everything to be rendered pictorially before our eyes.
How do you see, you've made a differentiation between comic books and comic strips. Where do you see the roots of comic strips? Because that is part of something that I'm interested with this. I'm not specifically focusing on Batman.
The roots of comic strips?
Yeah.
That's simply the newspaper cartoons. I've no interest at all in the idea that there is an art form called comics, which is entirely comprised of sequential images, and the practitioners of which I am supposedly one, are all naturally related to each other. I reject this idea. I have no interest in it. I have no interest in comic books, in fact. I don't read them, and I hate it when I'm called upon to explain them and justify them.
And that's what I'm looking for here, is to get that blunt, honest opinion. So that's great. That's exactly what I'm interested in finding out.
Right.
And if you
remove that bit from the first bit, where I've defined what a comic book is, be careful of the context of that.
Yeah, no, it's...
I've no interest. I'm prepared to accept that what Seth does, or that what Art Spiegelman does, are outside of both of those categories. And if there's something outside of both those categories, it's dangerous to give it a name, because that just starts an argument. You can't do it without getting into an argument. So I prefer to leave it nameless. It's like in The Sopranos, where they refer to, you know, that thing of ours.
Matt Madden is the co-author of Textbook on Cartooning, Drawing Words and Writing Pictures, and as well as his own comics, including the book Odds Off. He currently teaches at the School of Visual Arts in New York, crafting the brains or artistic tendencies of many young cartoonists going through there.
The common line, actually, which Kim Deitch was in our class yesterday at SVA and was repeating the same line, the way I kind of conceive it, that the at least in America, you know, there's the kind of the turn of the century, roughly contemporaneous development, if not invention, at the same time around, you know, film, shortly after photography, radio, all this stuff, came around about the same time. And the thing that sets comics apart, lamentably, from all these other media, is that it just had arrested development, in my opinion, and a lot of people's, and sort of, and the I think the two reasons for that are just the general commerce that it was you know, used to sell newspapers at first in the U.S. and the you know, and then even when stuff did start to happen, like the EC comics and whatever, the Wortham trials and the Comics Code Authority kind of scuppered any hope of it continuing to develop, and, you know, at least some of the mature stuff that, you know, someone like Harvey Kurtzman and Bernie Krigstein and people like that were working on at that time. And for me as an artist, what, you know, the real shame of that is that there's never been an avant-garde in comics, at least not until, you know, sometime in this, you know, basically the undergrounds count as the first sort of under, you know, avant-garde, I think. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, and that points out like a something unusual about, I think, about the that typical line about it being about comics marketed to kids and especially the Wertham stuff, is that, you know, this Surrealist and a lot of other artists adopted all kinds of other media, including film, you know, dating back to the 20s, you know, the Dada artists as well. And often I find it a shame and a little bit surprising that none of them ever actually made comic strips, you know. Especially, you know, everybody knows that, you know, Picasso read Crazy Cat and, you know, Nick Bertozzi has these great fanciful but very plausible, you know, ideas about Picasso having developed cubism after reading like Mutton Jeff and Popeye comic, you know. It's a very appealing notion. So,
wouldn't Feininger work in that aspect you're talking about as far as...
Yeah, but Feininger's, yeah, I mean, he's an odd case. I mean, he's one of the very few that was coming out of the fine art world, did a strip for a while, and then went back to the fine art world. But I'm not sure that he really considered those two things on a par with each other. I'm not sure if there's any, you know, I've never read any account of what his feelings were about his painting versus the comic strips that he did. Certainly the art world doesn't accept it as part of his oeuvre, particularly, at least until, like, you know, the Masters of American Comics show and stuff like that.
My follow-up question then is, how do comics work? Or do you see that as something separate?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's, you know, obviously, some of what I said, like, has already been answered, because obviously, if I'm emphasizing the nature of time as being a part of comics, then a big part of comics is sort of, you know, sequences in time. I think that what happened, though, is comics, as they matured, they also acquired other traits. I think that one of the things we have to be wary of is the danger of making comics seem like it's just like one thing,
mm-hmm.
That can be easily defined in a sentence. I mean, I think that's, I don't want to be too critical of Scott McCloud here, but I think that that's a sort of danger that some theorists have fallen into, that they want that one sentence definition that defines comics and also defines what's not comics. And the idea behind that is that there's purity, right? You can define what a painting is, you can define what a novel is, so you should be able to you can define what a lyrical poem is, you should be able to define what a comics is. But I think that quest for purity is problematic because comics are an impure medium. You know, you already have the fact that they're an art form, but they involve mass reproduction, which is a kind of scandalous thing. Like, for most of history, like, art shouldn't involve reproduction. Art should involve the creation of something that's individual and unique. But even beyond that, I think the comics, because they involve the mixing of images with words, of, you know, space with time, there's always an element of impurity. It's a hybrid art form. And I think what we can say is that there's not one thing that makes comics. Comics emerged out of this historical background that I said, of print, increasing awareness of time, but then there were these other elements that came into play, one of which was word balloons and the ability and the idea, and that's actually also linked with time. Like, there were word balloons going back to at least the Middle Ages, but I think it's only in the 20th century where you had Edison and others being able to record voices that you have word balloons that actually try to mimic speech,
mm-hmm.
rather than word balloons that try to give you a broad idea of what a character stands for, right? So I think that there's a bunch of different elements that go into the making of comics, and that's why there's no pure demarcation between things like, you know, comic strips, comic books, gag cartoons, animated cartoons. I mean, they're all a little bit different, but they're all also related. They're kissing cousins. And so I think, I mean, yeah, so what I would want to maybe emphasize is that there's no, I mean, if we're taking a big picture, we can't say that there's, you know, any one thing that really is what makes comics work. I mean, earlier on I emphasized sequentiality, like the fact that there has to, you know, comics came out of this historical moment where there's an awareness of sequence and time. But what you see, interestingly enough, in the 20th century is people that are doing single panel strips, like for the New Yorker, or the type of stuff Ivan does. And
Ivan Brunetti.
Yeah, sure. Ivan Brunetti does. And that many other artists do. And some people would say, well, that's a comics. That's like a single cartoon. But actually, if you look at these things closely, they often have the element of time in themselves, because there will be the implication of something that happened in the past, or maybe something that will happen. You know, if you have a man who's like on the ledge of a building and he's about to jump, and there's somebody making a funny comment, there's like the sort of part of the drama of it comes from not just what's happening in that one moment, but what could happen. The man could jump, or he could not jump, right?
Yeah.
So even a single panel has time. And I think that's... I mean, this is perhaps roundabout and verbose, but what I'm trying to get at is that, like, when we talk about comics, we're not talking about one thing. We're talking about a bunch of tangled roots that are sort of, you know, interrelated and overlapping and have shared elements.
Scott McCloud is the author of the very much known Understanding Comics, as well as the follow-up book, Reinventing Comics and Making Comics. And he also just had the Zot collection that just came out. Scott's kind of a recognized voice in comics as far as understanding. Okay, bad choice of words, but he has his perspective that he's really been pushing, and a lot of people really been taking it in. And I think he's an important voice in the discussion of comics.
Well, you know, there's the roots of what we know as comics today. Probably go back to the 19th century, humor magazines, and, you know, the line gets progressively thinner, the causal line, going back to Topfer, and then it kind of stops. So as far as the continuity roots, you know, as far as the connectedness, I often look for roots of the formal qualities of comics and all of these comics predecessors, these proto-comics, that come up a lot, certain Egyptian wall paintings, things like the Bayeux Tapestry or Trajan's Column or whatever. But those are formal distinctions. There's no causal chain. So, I mean, I think that if you're looking for a family tree, I think you have stuff that was going on in Europe, Topfer being about the earliest example of this idea of stringing cartoons in a row to tell a story. And then it starts to get more solid and more of a continuous chain of influences, you know, with the humor magazines and going into America's explosion of comics at the beginning of last century. And from then on, you can sort of see, yeah, this person learned from this person, learned from this person.
Specifically, other people have mentioned the Bayeux Tapestry, citing that you see it as a form of comics within comics.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to elaborate on that?
Well, basically, I think of comics at their heart as being this sort of value-neutral distinction of putting pictures of sequence to tell a story. And I think it's helpful to look at them as separate from their historical cultural context, just for the purpose of understanding that there's this art form that stands separate from the culture. It doesn't mean that the culture doesn't exist, but simply that just like prose could be seen as a series of cultural influences and traditions, it can also just be seen as the art of making making marks or representing, you know, language through a series of sounds or symbols, just packing that down. Then you can look and you can see if a civilization had cropped up out of nowhere a million years ago and they started making marks and telling stories to each other and then were completely extinguished, and if they had no causal chain or link to any subsequent civilizations, we could still look at that and say, oh, they discovered the written word, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that's essentially what I'm doing. And I think it's useful on a few different fronts. First of all, it's helpful to look at these other forms and say, ah, here are people who've encountered this basic idea of telling stories with pictures, and they have some really cool ideas about how to go about it. And they don't have the assumptions that we have. They don't have the assumption that it needs to be broken up into these rectangles or that it needs to follow a grid or something like that. They also have things in common that I thought were useful when imagining future forms of comics. Like I like the spatial continuity, the fact that all these preprint comics that I came across, they always followed this basic idea that adjacent moments in adjacent spaces were the same. So you followed this sort of unbroken reading line, something that we don't have so much in print. And I thought, oh, this is cool. Let's do this in digital comics. You know, once we're past print, let's see if we can, recapture some of that. And then it's just in expanding our understanding of the art form going backwards, it helps us expand our understanding of the artwork going forward or in the present. And it helps us to look at something like airline safety cards or stained glass windows showing Stations of the Cross and say, oh, I get it. They're doing the same thing. And so, you know, the more different ways that people have imagined this art form, the more different examples or different viewpoints on the art form that we can learn from.
Distinguish editorial cartoons and basically single panel gags from any kind of strip cartooning. You know, from a daily strip up to a graphic novel, I consider that to be of a piece, at least a very closely related form of storytelling. You know, and it's like from, I've been reading this this book by Félix Fénéon called Novels in Three Lines. It's a thing that he wrote in the early in the 20s, I think. They were done written in the newspaper, and they're almost like Twitter, you know. They're little tweets, and they're little news items, but they often have this kind of encapsulates like an entire novel's worth of nuance and character into like three very brief lines. They're always stories about, you know, adultery and murder and patricide and drunken people doing crazy things. So in other words, you know, that might be like the literary equivalent of a daily strip. You know, he actually serialized them in a newspaper in France. But it's clearly, you know, works along the same lines as a short story in a novel. And like a gag cartoon panel or a political cartoon are different because, again, they don't have that, or as much of that linguistic component where you're not reading stuff in a sequence. You've got a single, sometimes just a single image to, laugh at or think about, and maybe the caption that creates a kind of juxtaposition. But that in itself is not, to me, is not comics, functionally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, personally, I'm not like, I don't have any interest in sort of defining it that way, and like, I have no problem with people including things like, single panel, like the Far Side or whatever, in the world of comics. But when it comes down to it, I don't really think of them the same way.
You know, the comic book and comic strips have the similarity in that many of them count on some sort of movement or some kind of manipulation of time, whereas an editorial cartoon, being a static cartoon, doesn't. They all have in common, of course, the verbal-visual blend, as R.C. Harvey puts it. But yeah, no, I think in pretty obvious ways they're different forms and formats, and even though they're related to one another, don't, you know, all kind of do different things.
I think in different eras, different arts performed the functions. Like, for instance, in the 18th century, you have the great portraitists like Ramsay and Gainsborough and Zoffany, people like that, who would paint for rich clients, and they would immortalize them for all time in all their finery and with remarkably handsome and beautiful features. Okay, with me so far?
Yeah.
What is the modern equivalent of that? The modern equivalent of that is not...
It's Photoshop.
...is not a painter painting faces in our day and age. He'd be somebody like David Bailey, photographic portraitist,
mm-hmm.
to the rich and famous. In other words, the function that... those painters performed in the 18th century is now performed by a different art altogether. It's performed by the art of photography. I don't think anybody gets a picture painted anymore. They'll hire the the famous photographers of our age,
the Leibowitz.
Leibowitz and so on.
Well, here's
these are the image makers of the rich and famous. It's a different art performs that function now. In the same way, as I was saying a minute ago, books are now available to everybody. So the function that was once performed by traveling plays is now performed by television.
Yeah.
It would have been performed by cheap books 80 years ago before films took over completely. That's partially why we have a genre of popular fiction which is entirely illustrated. We have become used to seeing the fantastical presented on screens. That it's not enough just to read about it in text. We must see the pictures. It changes from century to century. 100 years ago, illustration was the greatest thing that an artist could hope to do with his life. Illustrators became famous and could rise to very comfortable positions in the middle classes because books were filled with pictures. Whatever else we want to say about the Victorians, they made beautiful books.
Mm-hmm. I've got some fantastic weird Christian socialist magazines that my dad found on the family farm from, I guess, the 1850s and 60s, and they're gorgeous. These like huge, they're like tabloid size images, and it's Christian socialism.
Same with the old Harper's Weekly, those middle page spreads that Nast or Winslow Homer would draw for printing by woodblock. Those are huge, big things. When you sometimes see them opened out and framed. When you think that they just come out of a magazine.
What were the strengths of early comics and also their weaknesses?
Now, how early? Are we talking about 3,000 years ago or the beginning of the 20th century?
I would say the beginning of the 20th century or end of the 19th century.
Yeah, right. Well, let's go back to sort of the Big Bang. America's Big Bang, of course, was the newspapers, when newspaper or comics started showing up. That's when we saw a lot of really exciting early work from people like Winsor McCay, Frank King, or George Harriman. And isn't it weird? Suddenly, it is George, right? It doesn't sound right.
Suddenly. Yeah, no, it's George.
Yeah, it's George. I don't know why. His name just sounded wrong to me. And I think that at the very beginning, when something is fairly new, or at least when it feels new, people do have an instinct to want to explore. They want to just see the far corners of it. And I think people like McKay did that wonderfully. In many cases, the exploration was kind of the point. I think if you look at something like Little Nemo, you realize that his primary goal was to say, I can do this, I can do this, I can do this, I can show you this, I can show you this, I can show you this. He didn't have a particularly sophisticated narrative in mind. He wasn't writing Moby Dick. He was just like, let's go to a new place. How about if everybody gets big? Look, mountains. You know, which means that, you know, as far as its literary ambitions, that they were kind of off the table. It wasn't really the point. The point was that, yes, I can make beautiful things. And these beautiful things can be sent far and wide, can be printed up in editions of tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of copies and read at the breakfast table, and that's really, really cool. And then there was a sense, I think many comics historians have this sad sense that at a certain point, perhaps even coinciding with the invention of comic books, that our ambitions were scaled down a little, that the comic strips became more and more compressed and adolescent, or not adolescent, excuse me, that was the province of comic books, but more bland, and the idea of just simply giving somebody a laugh, you know, or something to pin on a refrigerator eventually, became its only purpose. And then the comic books were seen as having progressively narrower audiences. I have to say, though, as much as I love that period at the very beginning of the last century, as much as I admire the masters from that period, I don't think of that as a high water mark. I think the high water mark is now. And I think that what we're doing, both in terms of artistic exploration and maybe even more importantly, in terms of advancing the potential of comics as literature, I think what we're doing now exceeds anything that's been done previously. The last 15 years just knocks the previous 100 years on its ass.
The strength, I think, is the dominant... I would guess that the dominant art form that they were parroting or kind of taking from or kind of... You know, it's very theatrical art form at the time, and it's very direct, very blunt kind of communication to the audience. And also, you know, the early comics did was that they were very colorful, and I don't think that can be poo-pooed to a certain extent. Just kind of that sheer visual thrill of what that must have meant. I think some of us that are in our 40s or even late 30s and older can remember a time when kind of visual thrills were rare enough that when you caught something fantastic or kind of out of this world, it must have been, it was still enough of a thrill because they were so rare. And to have that come along in a time of kind of, you know, that when you didn't see things like that, you didn't see colors like that, you didn't see entertainment like that, that must have been a kind of a visceral, direct connection between reader and object that must have just been wonderful. And I think you can even see echoes of that on up into the newspaper strips of the 30s and then the early comic books, that it played that kind of role. You know, also that there weren't any rules. And I think we're kind of in that point again where there are fewer rules than there are now.
Yeah.
But, you know, comics wasn't one certain thing. There was kind of this assault of visuals and assault of styles no one had become so commercially successful that it dominated the approaches, at least at that early time. And that's why you can still look at some of the stuff that was done, the better stuff then, and it seems kind of thrilling and different and bizarre now. So... You know, certainly had more of a wide open canvas back then.
In terms of like the weakness, I mean, maybe Winsor McCay is a good sort of example of this. There's, because it's a pioneering period, they're not necessarily very sure about the integration of word and picture. So they what you tend to get is a lot. You don't actually see this so much in Topher because he was an amazing early master, but certainly Winsor McCay, there's a great deal of redundancy. The text that he has captions in his early strips, and also dialogue, which a lot of it simply replicates or tells you things that you can see is already going on in the image. And so there wasn't an awareness or a sense that, you know, you can let the pictures tell the story rather than just the words. Rather than have the words also act as a commentary. I think another weakness for most of them, not all, is just in terms of writing. That the writing is the prose and the dialogue is much weaker than the images. That you have a very strong visual culture in someone like Winsor McCay, but you know he's not as gifted in terms of his dialogue or his captions. I mean, there are exceptions even to that. I mean, I think someone like George Harriman is equally good in both what he is, you know, like his, if you can distinguish the two between, you know, like the writing, the dialogue, and what he draws. But in general, I would say that, you know, Harriman is an exception.
Mm-hmm.
And I think...
Well, Harriman's using a whole different kind of language as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I know. I mean, in terms of, like, his dialect and but, I mean, just the richness of language in the sense of he's drawing for everything. I mean, he's a very erudite man. He's in his strips, you'll see, like, you know, all these different American dialects, the dialect of Brooklyn, the dialect of the American South, African-American dialect, you know, Mexican-American dialect, and then also Yiddish, Latin, you know, Shakespeare. I mean, he has a very rich verbal style.
All in one page.
Yeah, all in one page. That's right, yeah. Yeah, but I mean, again, I think Harriman is rare. Like, I don't think the early comic strips, you see that so much. And I think in a lot of the early comic strips, the narrative is not so strong because they're just they were mainly Sunday pages, and the interest was to you know have this wonderful visual sequence and then maybe a punchline at the end where Little Nemo wakes up on the bed. And I don't think in the early days, and you had daily strips like Mutt and Jeff, but they just generally involved like a joke where at the end Jeff kicks Mutt or Mutt kicks Jeff, or one throws a brick at the other. So it wasn't until later that you get the more sort of extended sequences. So the early comic strips also, I mean, a lot of them came out of vaudeville. They came out of, let's have yucks, and some of the jokes are still very funny. But I mean, I think that's definitely like a weakness that they didn't have at that time, the idea of an extended narrative, which I think came later in the great story strips of the 1920s, and then later in comic books and in the graphic novel.
How has that changed in time?
Well, I mean, I think that, just like anything, when something becomes, when there's a commercial standard, you end up, people bring certain expectations and bring a certain professionalism and a certain kind of knowledge as to how best to financially leverage a product, and it kind of dissuades innovation, discourages doing things outside of the things that we know are most profitable. And yeah, I think in terms of the kind of printing that we get too, especially newspaper printing, is much different now and not as splendid as some of those early broadsheets. I was looking at that Rose O'Neill book that Trina Robbins put together, and there's that kind of basic realization that it's astonishing that they were sticking these magnificently illustrated broadsheets into Sunday supplements. And now, it's kind of like we get color Lockhorns or color Howard Hughes, and it's very kind of simplistic color to it. But yeah, I mean, there's all that stuff that you probably know about, which is the newspapers shrank and shrank the size of strips, and in the 50s or after the war, and which kind of became the standard in the early 50s, and so there was no you end up chasing money to a certain extent, I think, and as certain commercial forms become the standard, it kind of becomes more difficult to rip off of that. And that also has an effect content-wise with comics too, in that you're constantly having to reinvent the wheel. People don't realize that there were comics for adults back in the day, and not only in the sense that soap opera, people were reading soap opera comics in the 30s, but there were also woodcut comics and things that certainly an adult could read, but the people in the 1970s kind of felt they had to to kind of reinvent the wheel, and kind of, from what was left, there's very little cultural memory of that time. So,
comics to me are basically a narrative language. Although I agree with if you get the hardcore, if you're trying to be really semantic about it and nail down what comics are the way Scott McCloud has tried to do, for instance, I do think the text is not essential. There are so many good wordless and very successful wordless comics out there that text is not essential, although it's in fact a part of 90% of comics that are out there. But I guess more importantly, I think comics read like language more than, when you read a comic, it's like you're reading, it's closer to reading like a short story than to, say, studying a painting. Because you need to, you're looking at a series of basically linear information, at least the panels and the pages run in a sequence. A given panel can be very pictorial and very plastic, and in reading an individual panel, there's a certain amount of circuitousness then. But even with the panel, and I would argue even if there's no word balloons there, you still tend to scan it in the left to right, top to bottom text sort of way. And regardless, once you're onto the next panel, you're starting to read a series of symbols, you know, that are that can be drawings, that can be text, which when combined in sequence with the ones that follow it, slowly build a kind of narrative. They build narrative sentences, if you will. And that's very different from just looking at a drawing, where you just sort of linger on it and your eye kind of wanders in varying circuits, and there's no particular, you know, entry or exit point that you're expected to follow. And I think that's why in recent years, and like Chris Ware, I think, would be a big proponent of this, but also in mini comics and artists who draw in a very simple, unadorned style, the extreme being Matt Fazell doing stick figures, but also think about John Porcellino, or David Mazzucchelli, who we were just talking about, the way his, you know, the more elaborate, illustrative style of his Marvel work has kind of stripped down to a much more graphic, designy style.
Very simple.
More recent work.
Symbol,
yeah,
oriented.
Very symbol-like. Yeah, I think he's very much thinking in the same way that that the drawing, although it undeniably has meaning within comics, it's not the primary carrier of what comics are. It's the sequence, not sequence. Is a kind of syntax.
Where does Wortham's studies on juvenile delinquency belong in the development of the medium?
What does a car accident belong, in the development of a drunk teenager? I like that metaphor, actually, because that puts the blame on both sides, doesn't it? No, it was bad. I see the whole Wortham period as basically he was an opportunistic infection, with people with compromised immune systems get pneumonia. And it knocks him for a loop. That's what happened. The compromised immune system was the broad assumption that comics were semi-literate kiddie fare. So all you have to do is come in and say, and they're obscene and evil semi-literate children's fare. It's like, oh, okay. Well, they put rat poison in the baby food. Time to get angry. And but if it was established in advance, if people understood that comics were like prose or movies, that you could do good stuff with them, that you could aspire to the same heights as in other art forms, then Wortham wouldn't have gotten as much traction. But we were an immature industry, we're an immature art form, and so it was possible for others to define us. So recently Wortham has been, I think, given a pass by some historians, and I know they've done some good scholarship on this, and I don't want to slight that, nor do I want to claim that I've gone over it with a fine-tooth comb, but there were a couple of things that Wortham did that I think I'm willing to just consign him to hell for those alone. Gross misreadings of some noble attempts to do something more with comics, especially one regarding race relations that I thought Wortham's description of was so blatantly, libelously wrong. He must have known. He must have known that he was lying to condemn both the work of art and the people who created it. And I say fuck him for all eternity for that. I don't care what else he did. I don't care what other motives he may have had. He does not get off ever simply for having done that alone. But again, I don't, that's not to say that taking a broader view of Wortham isn't in some way useful or, proper. This is not to in any way denigrate more recent scholarship and people who are trying to understand Wortham with a more dispassionate air. But, you know, I could understand. I mean, it would be helpful to understand the Middle East with a more dispassionate air, but I can also forgive people whose family members may have been blown up by a bomb or a missile, why they might be not in a mood to forgive. And I consider, you know, people who've worked to improve comics over the year, they're my family. So fuck anyone who blows them up.
I've never heard you so, it's like your blood's boiling.
Yeah, no. It's just like, this guy does not get off, I'm sorry. I'm the witness, I'm the guy who shows up, you know, the family member who shows up at the hearing, the parole hearing.
Yeah.
Like, he's basically...
You've got the photos.
Yeah, right, I got the photos.
The family photos. Maybe a little picture of Wally Wood looking sad.
Yeah.
I mean, the early comic books, as I mentioned, you know, where they're sort of plebeian art form, you know, very disreputable, but they had a huge audience. I mean, virtually every kid in America and Canada was reading them. I mean, where them definitely had an impact, just in the sense that he was the first person to write a book on comic books, right?
Yeah.
Like in that sense, he's like a pioneer. And he also, you know, raised in his own way the issue, you know, the issue of what the impact of the media might be. And he took a very sort of, you know, negative view towards the medium, seeing, you know, not just the contents of the medium, but the medium itself. Like, he thought that the printing, the style of art, the use of words and pictures in that way is all, like, bad. But, I mean, he, even though he had this negative view, like, I think it's interesting that he raised the issue of the nature of the medium. I mean, it's hard to know what the impact of his work is, just in the sense of he wasn't the first one to criticize comic books. There were, you know, anti-comic movements going back to the early days of the comic strips. There were people who thought the Katzenjammer kids were, you know, a bad influence on kids. And so throughout the history of comics, you've had this critique. I mean, and I think he articulated the critique, but in a powerful way, and that has an influence, but I don't think he should be singled out. Like, I'm against sort of great man theory of history.
Yeah.
To say, you know, well, if Wirthin wasn't there, things would have been different. Because if you actually look at it, you know, even from the first earliest days of Superman, there were people in newspapers criticizing comic books as being bad for kids. And by the late 40s, even before Wirthin got into it, you had the movement against crime comic books. I mean, in Canada, the crime comic books were banned in, like, 1947 or 1948. So that was well before Wirthin wrote his book, Seduction of the Innocent. So I think Wirthin in some ways was the figurehead, or he was the leader of this movement, but the movement would have happened without him. And I think the movement in a lot of ways was inevitable, just because you had people who were selling stuff to kids that at that time wasn't socially acceptable, right? Like, in general, parents can control what their kids could, like, see and watch, right? Like,
yeah.
If they're in the home, you know, they can know what they're listening to on the radio or watching on TV or what books they're bringing. But comic books were, like, this form that liberated kids. Like, if you had 10 cents, which everyone could have, right? Like, if you had 10 cents, you could buy a comic book, or you could borrow a comic book from one of your friends. And so this is a comic book that gave kids what they wanted. And unfortunately, what kids wanted was stuff that their parents didn't want them to have, which is a, you know, time-honored story. So in some ways, the battle over comic books, you know, seems almost inevitable. That, you know, the comic book industry thrived on, you know, all this sort of sexy, violent stuff at a period in, you know, history in the United States, in Canada, but also in Europe and in Japan and in Mexico, where, you know, people wanted more control over what their kids wanted. So in that sense, Wirthin is more like a symptom of this like issue of the battle between parents and their kids. He's rather than the cause.
I think it pretty definitely did. I mean, you know, I think the in the EC comics, at the very least. I'm not sure that, like, they were, like, Marvel and DC were, you know, ready to start doing graphic novels and got squelched by Frederick Wortham. But I do think that, you know, among all of the sensationalism and you know, violence and gore that was occurring in Tales from the Crypt and all these DC comics, they were, you know, they were stabs at stuff of something that was much deeper than what we've seen before. I mean, to name two examples, Krigstein's Master Wraith,
mm-hmm.
and Kurtzman's Corpse on the Imjin,
yeah.
are two stories that, you know, are published in the very same publications that led to, you know, led Wortham to write his book and eventually to the trials and the Comics Code Authority. And these are they're popular entertainment, but they're extremely rich works, you know, that function at a literary level of, you know, visual themes and motifs and a really tight narrative structure and, you know, sort of interweaving of text and imagery and repetition and variation and the page layouts and all kinds of stuff. And I think that kind of cartooning didn't stop entirely, although I think, you know, Krigstein faded out of cartooning pretty quick after all of that. I don't know if that's a directly result of Wortham or not. So it's maybe not quantifiable, but to my mind, it definitely had a pretty damaging effect on comics as a whole, and especially on that little bud of, you know, artists who are starting to look for more mature themes. Basically, you can't just have the mature, ready for Reader's Digest themes without the sex and violence. Basically, you know, they're sort of part and parcel, and it's very hard to separate those out. You know, you might get a very genteel artist who just produces stuff for the masses that's also at a high literary level, but more likely you're going to end up with, you know, Robert Crumb and, you know, people doing stuff that's new and rich, but is also a little bit dangerous, you know?
Well, I think one of the interesting things about that is it really creates a schism. It kind of created a schism between comic strips and comic books and put some real nails in that coffin. In terms of, you know, coloring it almost all the way back to the medium rather than the nature of the enterprises involved. And there was the NCS, or the National Cartoonist Society, did everything but throw, like, the comic book side of the industry under the bus, as the saying goes, in order to kind of differentiate what they did, this kind of wholesome, higher-brow entertainment and these kind of, you know, crazy, lurid comic books. And I always think that's, you know, kind of a split that still exists today. You know, even 5 or 6 years ago, I worked in comics at Fantagraphics for about 6 or 7 years, and after that I did a comic strip. And the difference in people's reaction when what I was doing was amazing at that time, even like the early, you know, late 90s, early 2000s. It just, you know, comics were basically, like I just said, I was working in dwarf porn or something. Whereas working in a comic strip, that was understood, you know, it was respectable. That was something you could do. And I always think that kind of crystallized at that point. You know, it's a central, it's a central myth for a lot of people, I think. The kind of comics as this put upon, you know, people interpret that separate myth. You know, like, in other words, if you were to sit down and have coffee with comics, like some, you know, entity called comics, and he was to tell you were on a date with comics, and you had that long discussion about the great events in your life and the life-changing events, you know, and the kind of ramble that sometimes happens at the end of a long conversation between two people that don't know each other, you'd probably know if they bring up the Wortham hearings a lot. I mean, it really is kind of like the central, depending on how you interpret it as this kind of, you know, comics as this lurid, awful thing, comics as this art form that got kneecapped by these horrible government people, the big comics companies ganging up on Mr. Gaines and EC. You know, there's all sorts of kind of resonant material there, the kind of story of comics that all kind of come out of that time. you know, that or that event. You know, for the comics itself, I'm not sure, you know, over time if that's going to end up being as important as it seems to those of us that kind of grew up chafing against the code.
Mm-hmm. Those of us that grew up knowing Crumb.
Yeah, kind of. You know, and where that was kind of different because of what... I don't know. There was that, you know, I think, like, the 70s and stuff... And the way that affected the other part of comics, you know, there was always this expectation, you know, if only we could have the freedom to do what we wanted. And in a way, kind of, Crumb kind of spoke against that because Crumb just kind of ignored the comics code. Whereas there was this commercial side of comics that was always kind of, you know, complaining that they were under the yoke of whatever, you know, they couldn't show, you know, Batman, I don't know, shooting up or something. And this was...
that didn't stop...
You know, like, there was still, like, there was still some sort of slavery involved, you know, yeah. in doing kind of creative slavery involved. Whereas Crumb just, and, you know, and Wilson and all those guys just kind of, you know, ignored the code, made fun of the code, kind of put the, you know, EC comics up on a platform that I'm not sure they'd be on without the code. It's a weird thing.
I think it pretty definitely did. I mean, you know, I think the... in the EC comics, at the very least, I'm not sure that, like, they were, like, Marvel and DC were, you know, ready to start doing graphic novels and got squelched by Frederick Wortham. But I do think that, you know, among all of the sensationalism and, you know, violence and gore that was occurring in Tales from the Crypt and all these EC comics, they were, you know, they were stabs at stuff of something that was much deeper than what we've seen before. I mean, to name two examples, Krigstein's Master Wraith,
mm-hmm.
and Kurtzman's Corpse on the Imjin,
yeah.
are two stories that, you know, are published in the very same publications that led to, you know, led Wortham to write his book and eventually to the trials and the Comics Code Authority. And these are they're popular entertainment, but they're extremely rich works, you know, that function at a literary level of, you know, visual themes and motifs and a really tight narrative structure and, you know, sort of interweaving of text and imagery and repetition and variation and the page layouts and all kinds of stuff. And I think that kind of cartooning didn't stop entirely, although I think, you know, Krigstein faded out of cartooning pretty quick after all of that. I don't know if that's a directly result of Wortham or not. So it's maybe not quantifiable, but to my mind, it definitely had a pretty damaging effect on comics as a whole, and especially on that little bud of, you know, artists who are starting to look for more mature themes, which you can't... You can't just have the mature, ready for Reader's Digest themes without the sex and violence, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, they're sort of part and parcel, and it's very hard to separate those out. You know, you might get a very genteel artist who just produces stuff for the masses that's also at a high literary level, but more likely you're going to end up with, you know, Robert Crumb and, you know, people doing stuff that's new and rich, but is also a little bit dangerous. You know,
I should mention that Wortham's influence was a bit mitigated by the fact that his arguments weren't scientifically sound and they were rejected by his own profession. That's to say, the vast majority of people, other than Wortham, there were many other psychiatrists and people in education who were studying comics in the 30s and 40s and 50s. If you look in the bibliography of some scholarly books, you can find literally, like, you know, scores of articles in academic journals about, you know, like, what are the impact of comic books. And the vast majority of scholars, psychiatrists and specialists in education, came to the conclusion that comic books had, you know, no impact whatsoever. Like, in the sense that the child's background, you know, whether they're rich or poor, whether they're abused by their parents or not abused, has a much greater influence than, you know, whether they're reading comics or not. So that was the consensus view, and the consensus view in media studies, which was sort of emerging, right, in the 40s and 50s, is that there was the idea of, you know, like, that media effect is negligible, that the people are influenced by what's around them more than what they read or what they see. And the reason people came to that conclusion was that they did sort of social scientific tests where they tried to control for varying factors. So instead of just looking at a random group of kids, or instead of looking at, like, you know, a bunch of kids who are in jail for juvenile delinquency and finding out whether they read comics, they looked at, like, you know, a random selection of kids, rich and poor, you know, black and white, from all over the country, and tried to isolate factors. And what they found when you control like that is that, you know, comic books can't be connected with antisocial behavior. Now, Wortham had a very different methodology because he was a clinical practitioner. So he ran a clinic, right? Yeah. And he was in Harlem, and he, you know, he was very concerned with issues of poverty and discrimination. And then he had clients, kids, who were, you know, damaged or had problems, and he's trying to help them. And he noticed that, well, they were all reading comics. And so he sort of jumped to the conclusion that comics were a contributing factor to what was happening. But, I mean, that's very much a clinical way of looking at it. That's the way someone who is, you know, narrowly focused on the end result might look at it. But people were looking at it from a more broader perspective, and using the methodology of social sciences, came to the exact opposite conclusion. So one of the paradoxes of Wortham is that even though he had a historical effect in, you know, raising the alarm about comics, and it possibly, although he didn't approve of the comics code, of leading to the events that led to the comics code, scientifically his work has not had an impact, and has sort of, and that's sort of one reason why we've never seen a replication of Wortham in subsequent debates, like over, whether it's over comics or movies or video games, the sort of Wortham point of view has really been marginalized.
Mm-hmm. The Muhammad comics controversy, and mm-hmm. of lack of a better term, and I don't want to worry too much about the specifics of what happened, but more in the, is it an isolated incident, or is it part of a greater scope of the medium?
I don't think it's an isolated incident, because as I mentioned, there have been sort of scandals about comics from the earliest days of comics. And I think that one way to sort of conceptualize it is to maybe think about why the visual is more inherently shocking than other forms of representation. That's to say, although, I mean, obviously, people were upset over Salman Rushdie as well, so people can be upset over novels. But I think if you take the broader view of history, things that are visual are much more likely to incite these sort of censorship debates. And I think part of it, I mean, the best discussion of the whole controversy was, I thought, Art Spiegelman's discussion in Harper's. And I think that the point that Art made is partially about the nature of sort of icons and the sort of tradition of resistance to icons. It's not completely within all forms of Islam. There are forms of Islam that have varying attitudes towards images, and then some of them are very anti-representational, and others are more open to representation. But and certainly in other religious traditions as well, in both Judaism and Christianity, there have been periods where there's been a sort of various sects or factions that have destroyed icons or destroyed images.
Would this be relative to, say, Reformation era iconoclasm?
That's one example of the Puritans and the sort of destroying of icons, as seeing them as being part of Catholicism. But even earlier than that, in Byzantium, there was during the period of Eastern Christianity in Byzantium, they had an anti-iconic movement during the Middle Ages. And more deeply, I mean, I think within all the sort of monotheistic religions, there's the idea of the graven image, right? I mean,
yeah.
That's one of the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not make graven images. And so all of them implicitly have this idea that, you know, God is sacred, God cannot be seen, right? Because that, you know, this is a pivotal story that is in the Hebrew Bible, but which is, you know, agreed to by Christians and Muslims and Jews, which is, you know, like Moses could not see God, right? Moses could only see the backside of God. You cannot see God, right? So you cannot represent God. And so within the sort of, what you could call the Abrahamic tradition, the monotheistic religions, there's a very strong resistance to images, especially of the sacred. And I think that in some ways that's partially at the root of the Muhammad controversy. But I mean, and more generally, I think the resistance to images comes from the fact that images can speak much quicker and to a much broader audiences than words can, right? That if you have, you know, like the Muhammad cartoons could be seen by everyone, and even though they could interpret them differently, people could, you know, people from a vast range of backgrounds could get the gist of them, right? So in some ways, they're very different from, like, you know, like a book or where you have to take the time to read and not everyone can read. So there's a sense in which the visual is always problematic, and then the visual is always open to controversy in a way that, like, more abstract forms of representation aren't, right?
Yeah.
So I think that there's, like, perhaps if you could draw a spectrum between, like, sort of, you know, visual representation, cartoons at one end, and things that are more abstract, whether it's music or maybe even abstract art, right? Like, which is visual, but which is not representational. People, you know, some people don't like, you know, very abstract paintings. They don't like Jackson Pollock. But I don't think there's the same impulse to destroy Jackson Pollock as there might be to destroy, like, if you did, someone did a caricature of you that you didn't like. You know,
yeah.
There's a way in which the visual is much more intimate and personal and direct. Well, this is all to say that, yeah, I think the Muhammad controversy is not just about the sort of, you know, whatever specific religious, political things were at issue, but also it has something to do with the nature of the medium itself. And also, I mean, now with technology, right, because they appeared in this Danish newspaper, but then they were on the internet, and people could, like, take copies and take them to Saudi Arabia, and then people were getting upset, you know.
Yeah.
So there's a way in which, like, sort of the media, the sort of easy ability to reproduce images, which is part of comics as well, played a role in us.
I think there are issues that are comics specific. They're about the form. And then there are issues that in which comics has common cause with other art forms, other forms of expression. And this is one of those. It's a free speech issue, as far as I'm concerned. And I do fall on the free speech side of that. I thought there was a very interesting debate between, I believe it was Art Spiegelman and Joe Sacco. Do you remember this?
That was the one they did in Chicago, their talk, I think?
Yeah, I think, I believe it was Long Distance. I don't think they were together. But both of them had weighed in on the Muhammad cartoons, and Spiegelman had taken the free speech position, Joe, if it was Joe, I think he had talked about cultural sensitivity and sort of the other side of the coin,
mm-hmm.
and made some very good points, of course, but I do tend to fall more on the extreme free speech side. In fact, I'm very uncomfortable with hate speech laws. Hate speech laws are essentially thought control laws. They are declaring some thoughts bad thoughts. And I don't think that's the place of government. I think it's appropriate to condemn as an individual things that you consider hate speech, but I don't like any sort of coercive techniques for suppressing speech, even abhorrent speech. So yeah, it has nothing to do with, you know, basically to answer your question, it has to do with speech and expression, and comics is part of the great broad tapestry of human expression. This is one of the times when it overlaps with that cause. Same way with the internet. You know, I in the evolution of comics on the internet, I saw the aesthetic questions having to do with comics' core identity, and I saw the questions of distribution and the connection with the audience as a case where comics was simply one of many media that were going through similar changes.
To answer that question directly is to muss up everything I've said before. I think the world of graphic satire is there's a world of graphic satire. I think the world of the strip cartoon may intersect that partially. The comic book doesn't at all. As I said, the comic book is a genre of popular fiction in the same way that fantasy is, or science fiction, or the Western. If you want to talk about graphic satire, I think it's certainly exciting that graphic satire can still cause trouble. But the only problem is it's caused trouble in a part of the world that we regard as medieval and somewhat backward, so I don't think it counts.
Okay. Thank you.
It almost doesn't count.
As comics or as graphic satire?
The trouble. the interesting fact that trouble has been caused doesn't count because it's happened in a part of the world that's a bit backward. It's no indication that it still has the power to do anything, that the graphic satire has any power in the modern world.
Can you think of an example where a comic strip has had power like that in Western world?
We're not talking about comic strip, we're talking about graphic satire. I think that the great cartoonists of the ages, like David Lowe, or I'm talking about political cartoons, mm-hmm.
And that's a question. You're on it.
I'd have to think hard because does that Stedman's work with Hunter S. Thompson had some kind of effect? I think it was an important statement in terms of graphic satire. I think we're talking about something different from comics there, though.
Yeah.
I don't think anything important has happened in comic books.
I think you've just made everybody cry.
For too many years, I think comic books are... I don't read them. I don't know.
But the thing I think that's interesting is having a difficulty thinking of contemporary examples. Are they as strong anymore?
In what?
In political cartooning, let's say.
Political cartooning.
Or is it just the fact that neither of us are well educated in that area?
I don't know. There was trouble with an Australian cartoonist last year. Bill Leake was drawing our Prime Minister as Tintin. And he got into trouble from the Hergé estate. So he caused trouble, but it wasn't trouble caused in the old sense of upsetting, you know, your caricature's upsetting someone. He'd misappropriated Tintin in order to do it, and he'd upset the owners of Tintin.
I've heard they get upset easily.
Yeah. So I think that's a sign of the modern age, is that the Prime Minister didn't get upset, that the owners of Tintin got upset. Commercial interests were more likely to be offended than the subject of the satire was.
I have a kind of a different point of view about the Muhammad cartoons than a lot of people do, in that I am equally critical of the clerics that promoted the cartoon and used it to create the riots, but I'm also equally critical of the publishing move that the newspaper made, mm-hmm. the stunt aspect of it. And is it a big thing in the history of cartooning? Sure, because it's the biggest story that's ever happened where people died that has as its core root cartoons. and their ability. And I think it, I remember at the time what it reminded people of, or what people were kind of, the learning curve for a lot of people was just finding out how important cartoon iconography was as a tool and as a communicative tool in the newspapers all over Africa and the Middle East, stretching into the near, you know, all the way over to Pakistan, I guess. In that you had all of these, that it was, you know, that it was something that anyone would get upset about, first of all, that these matter and that this could be communicated to people in that way. I guess I see it more as a journalism story. The more interesting aspects of it are the journalism aspects of it. But the cartooning itself was, yeah. I mean, they weren't very good cartoons, as Art Spiegelman points out. A lot, you know, except maybe that bomb in the turban cartoon. That's kind of a cool-looking cartoon.
I like the one with the cartoonist looking over his shoulder.
Yeah, no, that's cute. That's a cute cartoon. You're right. I don't forget which one. Who did that one?
A name I could not pronounce.
Yeah. But, you know, it's kind of interesting in all the standard ways it would be interesting, but I might think of it more of as a journalism story. I mean, the thing that was interesting to me was just how many people bailed on reproducing them and the kind of weird reasons they gave why, and people were kind of genuinely scared and not sure that they needed to be, and
people were scared to talk about it.
Yeah. The interesting thing that a lot of people don't consider is just the fact that, you know, there's that ironic distinction, you know. It's like, people are dying over cartoons?
Yeah.
You know, that kind of drives a lot of the interest to it, whereas I don't think that there's that element to, say, the pictures of Muslim prisoners being tortured or something. No one's surprised. Like, photographs? People are dismayed over photographs? Well, of course there are, you know. And then there's that element in comics where there's this kind of, like, wackiness, the irony to it, you know. They're cartoons, and yet people are dying. You know, imagine that. Now, that guy went to jail for cartoons. So there's, it kind of shows you that in a broader scale, there's still that cultural perception of comics as being innocuous and for kids.
I guess that could be kind of specified with that current case. Was it Handley?
Sure. Sure. Where his lawyer kind of backed out because they didn't think that. I mean, there is that element in comics a lot. Comics are very conservative. I mean, comics people are very conservative, so you always see those elements kind of break out. But yeah, there's always that thought in the obscenity cases that as soon as you, that the baseline is, you know, if not childish, then not bizarre, not unacceptable, and that if you show someone, there's an extra cultural kick for doing something that's kind of sick or off the cultural norms in comics form, because comics form is still seen as innocuous in some way. That people's gut reaction is different than their considered reaction. You know, you can talk through anybody and say, you know, there's, you know, you can explain that, you know, in a couple of minutes you can explain to someone and get their heads to wrap around the idea of comics that adults read. You know, by describing Doonesbury is what I used to use all the time back in the 90s when no one really understood what I was doing out in Seattle. And it's like, well, you know how Doonesbury is different than Beetle Bailey? And they go, yeah. And I was like, well, there are comic books that are different than the other comic books in that same way.
Yeah.
They go, okay. So, you know, they kind of, but then you whip out the, what was the example, you know, of Homer Simpson having sex with Lisa Simpson, and if people's first reactions are just going to be, you know, that's abominable. You know, that's not satire. That's just horrifying. And that's not, you know, that's a discussion that, you know, it goes all back to a cultural notion that, you know, our country's been kind of broken in half since the 60s, and
speaking specifically,
continue to fight those cultural wars, and, you know, Joe Blow by Robert Crumb is still as upsetting, if not more upsetting, than anything we see today, and that, you know, there's a certain mindset that's kind of stuck in place, and a certain mindset that's kind of left that place now for 40, 50 years.
And that's specific to the United States.
Yeah, you know, it's more specific to the United States, I think, for sure. I'm not really up on obscenity trials elsewhere or anything like that.
We don't really have to hear much.
I mean, certainly there's, you know, from what I've seen of, you know, what I see of international editorial cartoons, there's not a luridness to them, but they're certainly very, you know, can be very violent and very sensational.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly that, you know, Jacob Zuma and Zapiro, the South African cartoonist. I mean, he recently took it off as kind of a political gesture, but he would portray Jacob Zuma, the South African president, with a shower head on his head because he had once said that he had showered after having sex to rid himself of AIDS. And that's about as brutal of editorial cartoon. Can you imagine if someone did that here? You know, like something that nasty and kind of always drew, you know, this. You know, it would be like if someone, you know, it was basically like if you know, someone always drew Bill Clinton after a certain point with his zipper open.
Yeah.
And his stuff out. And it,
but
I mean, so
it's the same part that there's a certain horridness of having that as a statement of, you know, it's not like Bill Clinton went out and said, I had sex with her because it was, you know, good for my constitution. You know, this guy went out and said that the shower to get rid of the AIDS. I mean, that.
Yeah. I guess I'm more interested in the severity of the image, and the way people are able to process that. Whereas I think if we did that here, you know, people here get upset. There's more of a, you know, it's more of a jostling in American culture for the approval of the bulk of what's being represented in the culture, I think. Whereas, you know, there's some sort of, every time there's a bad thing, it's this kind of general conspiracy and hatred for you and you represent. And so I can't imagine if something as mean as the shower head had appeared with, you know, Sarah Palin or someone.
Yeah.
That
Sarah Palin.
Because there's certainly, like, you know, people are going over with a fine-tooth comb those, you know, representations of Palin or Obama to look for things to be upset about. Whereas I think there's more of a gloves off. You know, you can get away with just the nastiest drawings on the face of the planet Earth. The level of political discourse is different.
Thank you. ya ka buana la wai ne na ne la kawaii ole ya ai nai ya mai ona la ai nai ya ka buana la wai ne na ne la na